So there's been a tremendous move forward. That's not to say we should be content with the 55, but when you compare it to the five or six that existed before, it is a very large increase. Yes.
How are we going to get a woman elected to the United States Senate? I wish that you would talk a little bit about your thoughts.
It's an issue which is, of course, very close to me. I thought I had the possibility of winning, or I wouldn't have shifted from the House to the Senate. And it's a difficult choice. They ran a couple of polls before the final decision was made, and it appeared even at that point that it would be extremely difficult to win. I was running against a fellow member of the House who had been in the Congress 14 years. Our records were not that different in most of the large items. For instance, if you group them in work for health or work for education or liberal labor laws, we would have fairly identical records in these areas of broad public perception of issues. When you narrow them down into details, there was, in my view, quite a significant difference. The difficulty was in being able to project these narrow differences to the public to make them appreciate the importance of these differences, because there would be, of course, the competing television propaganda and so forth that we're all accustomed to witnessing during an election, which just blares out the general headlines of the candidate's background. And so I found that exceedingly difficult. In addition, because so many people were so worried genuinely, and they're all my dear, wonderful friends, they simply could not bear the thought that we would do anything wrong which would jeopardize my election. And they worried like whatever you want to call them in terms of the campaign strategy. And I am a person that has taken strong stands all my life. I believe that I've been elected to office for the last 20 years because I've taken some strong, hard, controversial stands in my district. But all the wonderful people who were helping me put together my Senate campaign said, "Oh, we've got to change your image." And they began to remake my television personality. And I think that simply complicated the whole picture beyond the ordinary voter's ability to really understand what was at stake. And the fact, again, the fact of the near comparability of our records, and so it clearly became simply a man-woman type of contest. And in that case, there was just simply no contest. I lost by about 10% percentage point difference between the two of us, and so it was a decisive victory for my colleague. But it doesn't discourage me. I think there will be another opportunity to run, and I'm gearing myself for that possibility. I don't plan to go back to the House, but I think the Senate is a challenge, and I would like to make that effort. But if you're in the Senate, you could make the worst type of statement, and you'd be reported all over the country. That's the significance of the United States Senate, and people appreciate the importance of it. Therefore, the stakes are terribly high, and the competition is going to be high. And it is not just the citizens of your state that are concerned. It's all over the country, and the money just pours in like you'd never know if people want to get rid of you. And there were a lot of people in the country that wanted to get rid of me, evidently. And so the money came in like 3 or 4 to 1. For every dollar I had, my opponent had 4. And so it was a tough situation, but I think that the women who make the decision to run for the Senate simply have to be supported in that same way by women all over the country. You can't say, well, it's a California race, and I've got my own thing going in Kansas or New York or Illinois. I think once there is a candidate that comes forward to run and people are supporting that individual, and I think it's incumbent for women all over the country to realize that this is something that's terribly important for everyone, that we must get a woman in the Senate. Yes. Yes, we have very, very few women who have tried to break into the Foreign Service. We have a unique employment schedule, which is different than any other branch of the federal government. In the other agencies in the federal government, you simply go through the regular civil service system, and that's it. But in the State Department, we have this unique creature called the Foreign Service Officer. And as in most of the elite institutions in our society, it's very difficult for women to break into them, and the State Department is no different. And so the numbers of women who are in the Foreign Service are mighty few. I can't give you the exact percentage, but they simply do not exist. And so when the Carter administration, for instance, were looking for senior women Foreign Service officers to appoint as ambassadors in the various posts that were being vacated, they simply couldn't come up with the numbers to choose from. And so the president, in many messages that he has sent directly to the State Department, and the Secretary of State himself in our weekly meetings, constantly is urging the department to encourage women to enter. And so wherever I have the opportunity, and I do quite frequently, where young people out of college or finishing graduate school come by to discuss job opportunities, I'm trying to urge these women to give it a crack and to enter the Foreign Service system, because it is unique. I think that in some ways we have contributed to the feeling among young people that they don't have time. Why should they go through such an arduous system like the Foreign Service Officer and 10 years from now get where they want to be today? And that is the biggest obstacle that I have to be able to rationalize for the young woman who comes in for an interview or for some employment counseling. They want their recognition. They want jobs that they believe they can handle right now. And, of course, the Foreign Service system does not operate that way. You start at the bottom, and you just work yourself up ever so gradually. And that is not a tolerable kind of a system for most of the young women who are finishing school today. And that is another reason why we have so few applying. And I think that we simply have to talk to the women and say, this is a unique kind of opportunity of service. And once you make it in, you have an opportunity in 10 or 15 years to achieve the role of ambassador and to be in charge of a foreign mission, to represent the United States government in foreign negotiations, that it is worth the 10 or 12 years. The young men who come into the service wait. There's no way that you can skip the system of jumping from a 7 to a 4. There's just no way that you can do that. Consequently, since the system operates in this way, I'm very hopeful that in my own way, I'll be able to encourage the young women to consider it as a worthy career, which offers in about 10 years the kind of exciting dimensions that they would like to have now. And I can understand their desires for it now, today, but I think it's worth the wait. Now, there are other kinds of jobs that are open for appointment, which you do not have to be a Foreign Service officer, but they are limited appointments. In other words, if I brought in a deputy and I left, that deputy would go with me. There's no job security to those kinds of appointments. There are what we call the reserve appointment, and those are a fixed time duration, 2 years, 3 years. When that 3 years are up, they must leave. And therefore, for someone who is interested in a career in the State Department or in the Foreign Service, that's not an appropriate avenue. But those avenues are available if you want to break in at the higher level today. But they don't offer any sort of security. And I think it is that versus starting from the bottom and working your way up that causes the great dilemma for the young woman seeking first or second job opportunity. The efforts of the U.S. government in the law of the sea has extended for some 15 years. Our position really is no different today than it was when it started, and that is in the common recognition that the ocean belongs to all mankind. The concept of heritage of mankind is the principle upon which the conference was first organized. It's very difficult, though, when you have to sit down and elaborate the rules of usage of the ocean, the surface, the water column, the sea bottom, and to get all countries to agree, particularly when the U.S. and Germany and Japan and U.K. and so forth have all the advanced scientific know-how to exploit the ocean and the developing countries do not. And that is where the big disagreement comes in. The lesser developed countries are not interested in any sort of a plan or a schedule which advances the early, quick, rapid exploitation of the ocean's minerals, in particular the seabed where the manganese nodules exist in the Pacific, where these nodules can be extracted, and then cobalt, nickel, and manganese, very high-grade situations can be taken from them, and will help meet the needs of this country. The developing countries don't have the need for these particular minerals. Manganese, for instance, for the manufacture of steel, principally, is the use of that particular metal. And they don't have a steel industry, so why should they care whether manganese nodules are extracted from the ocean or not? We care because there's a shortage of manganese. So again, it's a contest between the developed and the less developed. Their idea is to establish an international authority that will regulate who gets a license to sink down a drill for a particular mineral and where, and the conditions for such entry into the ocean bottom. The U.S. position is that to restrict it in this way and to make it difficult for the developed countries to have access is contrary to the notion of the oceans really belonging to everyone. This is a highly restrictive, then, kind of regime. And therefore, the conflict centers upon the extent to which these two broad elements of the world are going to be able to resolve it. The U.S. has no difficulty in agreeing to the payment of royalties to the international organization, has no difficulty in agreeing to limited licenses. But what the developed countries are insisting upon is the right of access without someone standing over and saying, you can't go in. And this is a matter of great contention. The new conference will reconvene in Geneva in March, and the same issues undoubtedly will be argued at that time. Most of the other issues dealing with navigation, freedom of the seas, innocent passage of the straits, pollution, ocean environment protection, all of these things have been basically agreed to, and there's no conflict. The one major conflict is who is going to decide which country can develop the ocean bottom, and in specific these particular minerals that I cited. There's also a hidden agenda, and that is the possibility that there might be oil in the ocean floor. And of course, for that reason, the whole issue is one which is enormously contentious and full of controversy. The U.S. government right now is in the midst of an intensive review as to what our position is going to be when the new conference convenes in the spring. So for that reason, I can't elaborate on the details of what posture we will be taking. I can only report to you what has happened thus far. That review will not be completed until the end of December. My bureau has a responsibility for elaborating what we think the State Department's policy ought to be on the law of the sea vis-a-vis our relationship with the other countries. But Ambassador Elliot Richardson has been appointed by the President to be the principal negotiator for the entire U.S. government at the Geneva Conference, and he has served in that capacity for a year. His job is to balance the Interior Department, Defense Department, Commerce Department, and everybody that has an interest in the oceans, one of which is the State Department, and therefore we do not take a preeminence in this issue. If the law of the sea should be successful and we did have a treaty of the sea, then it would be my Bureau's responsibility to implement it. Yes. College degree and taking a competitive examination. No particular degree, no particular area, although many of the students come in with degrees in international relations, going to specialized schools of international law or international relations, but that is not a prerequisite. There is a very tough exam that's given once a year, I believe, in December sometime, for which an advance application must be made, and the test can be given in each of the major capitals of the 50 states. The examination is very tough, and I think that the rumors fly about how tough it is, and oh, you know, what a horrible experience I had, and that sort of just passes from one person to another, and it affects, I think, an independent decision by the student whether to take the exam or not, to the great detriment, I think, of the individuals, that they are persuaded by what they've heard about how difficult it is. It is a general intelligence examination from all that I have been able to learn about it. History, literature, the arts, you know, languages, that sort of thing. After you pass the exam and are selected, then you have to go through even further intensive training in the Foreign Service Institute. That's just the beginning. But the competition, admittedly, is very high. No. No.
How many?
I don't know. It's been quite complicated this year because, as you know, someone went to court in the State Department alleging age discrimination, and in June the court ruled that the State Department's regulation regarding Foreign Service officers of mandatory retirement at 60 was unconstitutional. And so many Foreign Service officers who had been expected to retire at age 60 are not retiring. They could take a voluntary retirement, but they can no longer be asked to leave. Consequently, with the fixed core of Foreign Service officers at 3,000 plus or something like that, I think the limit for this year is much lower than it has ever been. Because of this unexpected development. But we assume that this is just a phase situation and that it will soon recover itself. But I know in trying to place people, even in my bureau, most of the senior officers in my section keep telling me that the endangered species in the State Department is that lowest level FSO 7 or six. They just are not in existence. And so the whole system is sort of weighed on the top. And you'd be surprised. Some very high-level FSO 3s and 2s are really doing jobs that should belong rightfully to the Foreign Service officers at the much lower level. If you join the Foreign Service Officer Corps, it is a permanent job of which you cannot be denied for any reason. And assuming you meet the basic requirements for promotion, you have regular promotions. You must also accept a transfer overseas for limited assignments of no longer than 8 years, with then so many years back on U.S. soil. But you have to make that advance commitment. You can't join the Foreign Service Officer and then refuse to accept an overseas assignment, because that is a tacit part of the commitment you give the department when you join. And so if it does develop that you don't want to leave when your time comes to leave, then you have to retire from the service. So there are some rather strict requirements on it, but it is a service which I think is not only exciting but extremely demanding. And for one individual faced against the world, it is a remarkable feeling to know that you are there representing your government and your people and that you are negotiating under those circumstances. And it's really quite a thing, I think, for women to achieve to, yes. I don't know. I don't know whether it's that bad, but it is a fairly tough exam to make. There is a middle entry level for mid-career women at the GS 13-14 levels. That opportunity is available. It's only a beginning kind of affirmative action process in the State Department, so I really can't direct you there because I don't know what the real opportunities and difficulties are. I know of only one individual that finally made it into the department in that mid-entry type process. And then in talking to her, she's not all too happy about the placement, the rank, and all the other things that she had to accept in order to come into the system. So it's not, those questions have not been really resolved. Yes. The other word for it, appropriate technology, yes. Well, it's a difficult question because our intelligence is that it is a term of derogation as far as the lesser developed countries are concerned. I mean, why should we decide for them what they can benefit from? It's for them to decide, and if they feel they want the latest version of the IBM computer, why should we deny them that kind of technology? It's an extremely delicate issue. Obviously, they say to us, we're not going to ask or want something that is inappropriate. So what's all this jazz about appropriate technology? Yet you and I and those who are dealing with the subject know that there have been many cases in the past where countries have sought technology which they have not been able to benefit from because they were not very well or wisely planned or implemented. So in the process of working out a U.S. strategy for this U.N. Conference on Science and Technology, which could well be held in the United States, we are trying to find a way of overcoming difficulty of, on the one hand, everyone in the United States who works on this issue saying we've got to come up with a strategy which will send to country A and B and C and D that which is appropriate at their level of development based upon a thorough study of their infrastructure and how much they're able to absorb. But you can't relate that kind of discussion or language with the recipient country. It simply will be unacceptable. So I think the virtue of the UN conference is that we don't really have to worry about that, actually, because the guidelines, which were carefully prepared by the planners for the last 2 years, state that for the lesser developed countries, they must do a country paper after thorough analysis, which describes exactly where they are in terms of their economy, their industrialization, their development, and to come forward with those kinds of strategies which they feel they can benefit from. So that would be one category of strategy national papers which will be tabled by next May. On the other hand, the developed countries have been charged with a different set of guidelines, which is to say, what are we prepared to offer and give? Then, you see, it will just be a sort of a shopping basket list here of the developed countries, which then the LDCs can come forward and say, well, of your list, we'll take A, or we'll want M or Z or whatever it is that we have listed. In that way, there can be then a match of expectations and desires for industrialization and development on the one hand with that which we have available to offer and the mechanism and the financing and so forth to make it real. The worst thing that could happen is the elevating of expectations which cannot be delivered. And so we want to guard very, very carefully that we don't be guilty of that kind of a situation at this conference. The United States has offered a bid to host it, and so it could well be a conference which will be held in the United States in 1979. Yes. No, I think it came from being kicked around. I went to law school, and I really thought that I was going to just make a whole pile of money and be a successful lawyer, and that would be my life. And I was quite content, quite frankly, in viewing the situation while in law school, to accept that really as the height of my ambition. Well, when I got back with my law degree, after walking the sidewalks and visiting everybody I could think of, there was no job available. And in most cases, because they just simply were not prepared to consider female lawyers at that early juncture, it just was unheard of. And so my next round of interviews were with government offices to get just anything that might fit the description of a decent job which a legal background would justify accepting, because I couldn't, of course, take anything less. And there were no job opportunities in the government area either in my home district. They would say, well, you're a young mother, your child is 3 years old, you ought to stay home, and the whole bit. And in many cases, they would say, well, we work nights, and we don't think women ought to be out at night. And I mean, I heard every argument that one could possibly expect under the circumstances. And so there was really no recourse for me except to find a little office with the lowest available rent and to hang up my shingle and go into private practice myself. Well, I didn't have a father that was a successful lawyer or an uncle or a grandfather or anybody that had been in politics, or the name Mink they thought I just picked out of the hat because it sounded cute or something. And so it was a very difficult thing to do, to sit behind your desk and look busy day after day without clients, without things to do that interested me in the legal profession in the first place. And so, lo and behold, I had so much time on my hands because of the conditions in which I found my society that I became active in politics. And I went to precinct club meetings, and I helped plan resolutions for our Democratic conventions and helped organize fundraising events and backed candidates and did all the rest, nearly consuming 50% of all of my available time in that kind of volunteer activity. Until one day I put my hand on the table and said, this is it. The time had come for me to stop doing this for other people and to do it for myself. And so that was the day I decided to run for office. And of course everybody laughed and said, you just couldn't make it, you're a wonderful person, but who knows, you don't have a name in politics and you're never going to make it, we love you dearly, here's $10. And they sent me off on my own. I had a committee of about 10 people willing to work for me, and we walked the streets and went door to door several times in the district This was my first campaign in 1956. I don't think even we believed we could win, but we were doing it with heart and soul and all the innocence that you could muster in anyone's first campaign. And we won. And so it just led from one thing to another. That was the local House of Representatives for Hawaii. We were still a territory at that time, and I just kept on moving from there to the territorial Senate, and then the state Senate when we became a state, and then from there to the Congress, and then in 1976 for the U.S. Senate. And so I think, as I think back, all the people who wish that I had not existed probably rue the day that they didn't help me get my first job. Thank you very much.